This is the Eurosnob Podcast.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into the Eurosnob Podcast. My name is Ian Smith, and we've got another special episode for you tonight. I'm joined by Alex, and I'm joined by Bill. Alex, what's going on, bud?
Hey, not much, Ian. How you doing?
I can't complain too bad. Billy, how about you?
Not much. How are you guys doing?
Hanging in there, man. Hanging in there. Sunday was not the most fun I've ever had watching an Arsenal game.
I mean, no, not at all. It was a little frustrating, to say the least.
They seem to just consistently in these matches, in these North London derbies, just make Tottenham like feel like they're so much bigger than they are, and they're not. And I wish we could just come out and pummel them. It was very frustrating to watch.
Now, what do you think is the biggest reason for that? I know we're really kind of jumping right into it, but was there one specific thing that stands out to you as to why we didn't do anything in that game?
I mean, I think the start kind of dictates how we're going to play. You know, I think when you come out the blocks first 20, 25 minutes, so slow, everything was slow. You know, we were letting Spurs control the game. There wasn't any sort of coordinated pressing. We had individual players pressing, and then the passing game was just off. I think, you know, there were a few players that are a little bit out of form right now. And, you know, credit to Spurs. They're a good defensive team. We really didn't start creating much until the second part of the first half. I know it made me feel weird to just give Spurs a compliment. So
I was going to say, I'm going to jump right in on that one. You said give credit to Spurs being a good defensive team. I don't really think they were that great, to be honest with you. They have this reputation of being a really good, high-pressing, high-energy team. I got to be honest, I didn't really see that. I thought there was plenty of space for us to take advantage of them, and I don't really think that they stopped us. I think it was more of a problem that we had with ourselves. I think we let them off the hook easy.
To some extent, yeah, but I mean, I don't think they've given up more than two goals in any game this Premier League season, you know? So I think you do have to give them some credit there. But, you know, we did have chances. The Iwobi chance early on, that's the one that kind of sticks with me. I think if Iwobi puts that early chance away, that came off of a beautiful piece of play, I think the whole game, you know, turns differently, because I think, you know, we have that early momentum, and, you know, we still get the goal towards the end of the first half. But I think if you put that chance away, you know, I think Spurs probably open up a little bit earlier and you maybe catch them on the counter. I know, Bill, I saw you shaking your head when I mentioned that it will be chance.
I'm not a professional. I'm nowhere near the caliber of Iwobi. But I mean, when you're in the team, you're in the team for a reason. How you cannot finish off that chance is something I just don't understand. And I thought his play was particularly slow. Somebody on Twitter said something like he's been poor for 5 to 6 games now. I mean, I disagree with that. I think the last 2, maybe 3 games, he's looked a little off the pace. It might have been a perfect time to maybe keep, you know, I know we're going to talk about him in a little bit, Ox in there. I mean, before the game, it might have been a good thought to have had or something. But, you know, I just think that on that kind of chance, with that kind of pace and you're coming down, it looked like he was falling down before he took the shot. No, I mean, I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, 100%. He didn't, you know, he hit that. One of the things that, you know, coaches always say, you need to shoot to score, not shoot to not miss. He looked just in his approach, and you hit it right there when you said that he was falling over before he even took the shot. In his approach to take that shot, you could even tell in his body that he was hitting that ball to make sure he put it on frame.
Right.
Like, he didn't attack the ball with conviction. He didn't attack that ball. You know, when you see somebody like Alexis on a chance like that, he hits that ball believing 100% that he's going to bury it. You could tell Iwobi just – he had absolutely no confidence when he hit that ball, and – he was falling, like you said, he was falling away before he even hit it.
I mean, he opened his body up, and, you know, the combination of that and falling backwards as you're doing it, you know, I think it is what you said. He was focused on not missing the target rather than trying to place it in the corner, because that's a shot, you know, any good professional should be able to bend into that right corner, especially with the amount of space he had and the fact that there was no defender within 5 yards of him, honestly. So you'd expect better there.
I'm gonna jump right there, and you say any professional, any decent player, not even a professional. If I miss that chance in a men's league game, you know, that's basics. Like, yeah. If I miss that chance in a men's league game, the amount of shit I'm taking because I missed that chance, like, that's ridiculous. He's 14 yards out, and he passed it to the keeper's feet. Like,
that's the thing. He didn't even make the keeper make a save. It just went right at him.
And, exactly.
You know, it sucked because that the piece of play that built up to that was gorgeous. You know, it was our best pattern of play in the entire game, in my opinion, just in terms of fluidity of movement, passing, and the pace that we attacked with. But, you know, towards the end of that first half, I think we started creating more. And I think, you know, to your point, there were certainly some openings there. You know, conversely, we also gave up quite a few openings, I think, with the line we were playing. You know, Spurs definitely had their chances as well. I mean, I think we went into halftime feeling pretty good, though. I mean, we got the goal. You kind of figured that the Spurs were going to come at us and that we could maybe catch them on the counter, get a 2-0 lead, and then put the game away from there. You know, Bill, what was your thought going into halftime? Did you have any sort of, you know, worry about losing that lead, or did you feel confident that we close out the game in the second half?
You know, but before the game, you have thoughts of, okay, this is either going to be, you know, a draw or we're going to win by a lot. And when we got that lucky goal in the first half, I thought, all right, I really felt more confident going into the second half. I just thought we were all around better team. Like, you know, your stat, they haven't given up 2 goals a game. Like, that's fair play to Spurs, but I have to, like, you know, I guess get on Ian's back with this. Like, I didn't think they looked that great. They weren't that impressive. The mouth breather was just back and, you know, nicked his penalty, whatever, you know. But I mean, I just really thought, all right, we're going to come out in the second half. I really thought Walcott was going to definitely nail one. And I thought maybe even if they brought Giroud on, maybe he put a header away for a nice 3-0. See you later, Spurs. Go back to the cellar where you belong. But once again, I think we give him too much credit. Dembele flails his body over. And, you know, Koscielny does make contact, but, you know, it's unfortunate. I really thought we could have had it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think, you know, like you said, Spurs really didn't look – they didn't look great. I never – not once at any point in that game did I get the feeling that we were going to lose that game. Even when they scored that penalty, I still didn't get the feeling. Like, in the past – that goal goes in, and instantly, as an Arsenal fan, we say, oh, no, here we go again.
Right.
They're going to catch another one. They're going to beat us 2-1 or 3-1. I never got that feeling once. No, I thought, like you said, when we scored that, when we got the own goal, I'm like, okay, cool. We got a goal here. We'll catch them early in the second half, go on to win 3-0, 3-1.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, exactly. And then they hit that penalty early in the second, and my thought wasn't, you know, here we go again. It was, oh great, now we're going to end up drawing this game.
I think, yeah, Spurs lacked a little bit of the dynamism we've seen from them in other games this season, you know, especially against Manchester City, where they just blitzed Manchester City, you know, with their pressing and coordinated pressing more than anything. You know, I think not having Dele Alli was probably a little bit of a hindrance to them, but at the same time, in midfield, you know, you still play you know, Dembele and Wanyama. So, you know, they had that physical presence, but not necessarily much in the way of chance creation. You know, I mean,
fucking cheaters in that midfield,
yeah, speaking of Wanyama.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that Wanyama went that whole game without being targeted is pretty remarkable to me, and remarkable, by remarkable, I mean pretty ridiculous.
I'm getting absolutely, I can't even stand. Did he even get carded? I don't even think he got carded.
He didn't get carded.
I mean, come on.
That's, I mean, he must have had 5 or 6 different tackles for which he probably should have been carded, or at least in accumulation should have gotten a card. So, exactly. When, you know, I think it's easier to be a good pressing team when you know you can get away with those tactical fouls time after time after time and not get carded for it. You know, I mean, to his credit, I thought Dembele had a really good game for them. You know, even without the penalty, I thought at times he brushed past our midfield way too easily. You know, because that's the kind of player he is. You know, he can power through midfield. He retains the ball well. He's got good close control. But outside of him, you know, Eriksen, you know, I've never really thought he was an elite player. I thought he's good. Kane didn't do much. I've actually been impressed with Son for Tottenham. I think he's a good player. You know, I think he created some chances. There was one time where he dummied Mustafi and got in on goal and had an opportunity. But, you know, it wasn't the usual Spurs. I think the Champions League game midweek had something to do with it. Although, you know, our Champions League game probably also had something to do with our energy level. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear how much you guys think that played into it. Or is that an excuse because we had that extra day?
For me, I mean, I don't think that it's really an excuse because they had a game midweek too. We have looked tired really since we started getting into the two games a week. And I don't know if that's necessarily that we're tired. I mean, they're professional athletes. How tired do they really get? And sorry.
The only time that I
touchdown. Sorry, guys. A little distracted there.
The only time that I think that it comes into play where even you can maybe compare it is when you're playing a team that has no European competition or no European football at all. I feel that maybe they get a little bit more rest in a way. They might feel more refreshed in some degree if they're the same type of team. But, you know, they both played Champions League games. Spurs arguably won after, you know, obviously, so they could be more tired, quote unquote. But I just think we were a faster team. We're in better form. I just think we gave them too much credit, and I don't know why. Arsenal always seem to give them so much credit in these games, and it's like, yo, just go out and treat them like the shit that they are. Beat them up.
And that's, you know what, that's a really good point there, that we give them too much respect in those games, because when you look at the lineup they put out there, how many players in that side get into this Arsenal team? Lloris, maybe?
You'd say Lloris. I wouldn't take either of the fullbacks.
I could see Eriksen getting into our team somewhere.
No, I don't think so. Where would he play? You know, maybe on the left wing. Maybe on the left wing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'll give you that. Right. And then I think informed Kane gets in. I know.
Not when Alexis is playing striker for us. He doesn't get in over him.
Well, I think, if you had if you had both of them in your team, you know, you can almost play them in a two, you know, up top.
Yeah. I mean,
but the point is, yeah, your point's well received, though, because I think in midfield, you know, maybe Dembele gets in over Coquelin.
Not if Arsene's the manager.
Well, yeah. If Arsene's the manager, Coquelin gets over Vieira. You know,
probably.
Yeah. You know, so you know what? I think on paper your point definitely has some validity. Where I think I looked at the roster, I looked at the squads and the subs bench, and I said, okay, I think we've got a decided edge here.
Right. Like I thought it was going to be like, all right. Like I had a little bit of the nerves, but this year it kind of seemed like the boys were more cutthroat. Let's go after the jugular, or let's control the game. Let's make them play. Either we want possession or we'll give you possession and hang back. Like they seem to control the game to a degree with just the level of intensity they played with. And I thought with Walcott coming back and being able to help out, Bellerin coming back and closing the ball down, double teaming to win balls back like he was before, I really felt even more confident that we could take them apart on that side. And it just seemed the first 20 minutes they played so timid. They were hanging back. They didn't want to move around. And I think somebody said it before that they were playing just slow. It just looked lethargic. And I, like I said, too much credit for no reason, in my opinion.
And you know, going back to when Alex was giving Spurs credit, and I really don't like to do this, but you do have to give them a little bit of credit, because the thing that I think was the thing that they did that was most impactful on the game is they really marked Ozil out of that game for really large stretches. And I think when he's, you know, again, going those, 11 Teg and 11, who does all those passing charts. Yeah, Ozil still had more touches than anybody else on our team through the first 70 minutes of the game. But a lot of his touches, it was he had somebody on him the second he had the ball. They did a really good job of marking him out of that game, not letting him get into those spaces, not letting him get in behind like he has been doing lately. And I think when you take him out of our, when you take him out of the game, that's such a major problem for us. Like, he's so important to how we play and that killer instinct that we play with, because he pushes that play from our midfield where we knock it side to side and keep possession. He's the one that transitions from that midfield possession to the attacking possession. So if you can kind of take him out of the game and Alexis isn't getting as involved as he needs to, where, you know, when Ozil's getting marked out, Alexis needs to drop back and kind of fill in that space and get on the ball. And he wasn't really doing that. So I think if you can mark Ozil out and get lucky that Alexis is off form, I think that's really what the issue was.
Yeah, I mean, I think in midfield, you know, it's an interesting point you bring up, because you said that maybe we didn't have someone to kind of play through the lines there and do that sort of thing where Ozil, you know, can make those passes, those probing forward passes. You know, I think Xhaka has that ability. He showed it at times, but, you know, a Xhaka Coquelin midfield, I think, can work, but not in the way it was set up. Because you had Xhaka playing as the defensive midfielder, which is fine, but then you had Coquelin playing almost box to box, which I will still never understand, because first of all, he's worthless in attack. He contributes nothing going forward. There's no scenario where he's going to score. If anything, he gets in the way. And at the same time, when we lose possession, because he's caught 80 yards upfield and now he's chasing back frantically.
You know, I just want to jump in really quickly on that point you made there about why Coquelin is playing the box to box and why Xhaka isn't. At least I've seen in the last few games, kind of played when he played with Elneny, I think it was, or when he's been trying to play more of a box to box, his positioning is all over the place. And that's when you start seeing him make those tackles where
he's slow.
Like, I don't know that it's necessarily – he is slow, so he doesn't have the recovery speed.
Slower.
You know, and I know I'm talking to two Xhaka fanboys here, and I understand that completely. But I think
don't you dare say a bad word about him.
Yeah. I am a little bit. You know, I think his defensive positioning when he's trying to get forward and getting back, I think that's when he gets himself into trouble. I mean, he doesn't have the recovery speed to get back into those positions. So I think that's probably why you see Coquelin playing the more box-to-box, because he does have that recovery speed to get back and forth.
Yeah, but the problem is now you have someone in the attack clogging up space who can't do anything with the ball.
I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that at all.
Like, I see what you – I can see the point you're making, and certainly, you know – but I think when you have Coquelin, if you play Coquelin a little bit deeper, sort of the role
–
Sorry, go ahead, Bill.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to – I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say, like, if you have him there and Coquelin's deeper, then his recovery speed isn't – I mean, not as needed, but Coquelin's back there. You know what I mean? And at least they have – he has that to rely on as long as he holds true to it. And, I mean, how many times does Xhaka – I mean, I guess he'll go forward a lot. I don't know.
I mean, you've also seen at times this year when Xhaka has gotten game time, when he does get into the attacking areas, he's very good, actually. You know, he finds little passes. He alleviates that creative burden off of Ozo. Like, several times this season, he's found these lovely through balls to some of the wingers or the strikers to find space. You know he can score goals like he did against Ludogorets when he got into the box. You know, when Ozo pushed forward and you know, collapsed the defense a little bit and Xhaka made that late run. So you know he can play that role, and I just think if you play Coquelin, like, I remember one game, I think it was a 2014-2015 season when we went away to Manchester City and we won 2-0, and Coquelin and Cazorla Ramsey was our midfield, and Coquelin just sat back, read the game, intercepted the ball, and got it forward, nice and simple. I think that's what Coquelin needs to do. When you get him charging into midfield, doing his one-man press, and then leaving all this space behind him, I think you're not utilizing what strengths he does have, and you're kind of accentuating his weaknesses.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, I definitely can't disagree with that at all. And if it was up to me, that's how I would go about setting it up. I just think that's my point was just, I think that's why we're seeing it set up the way we are. I don't think that Wenger trusts Xhaka yet defensively.
Although I will say, you know, about the trust thing, I found it interesting that we subbed Coquelin off and not Xhaka. So maybe that trust is developing, because I think you saw in the pre-match comments, you know, he was talking about Xhaka's discipline and this and that. But then he brings on Ramsey and he takes off Coquelin and not Xhaka. And I think in previous games, he's made the reverse substitution where it was Xhaka that came off.
And in that case, I think that was just it was a positive substitution. I think that was a sign that Wenger was trying to go and get that, going to get all 3 points right there. Because he does know that, I mean, obviously Xhaka, like we've said, is limited going forward. So if you're trying to go and get that goal, you take Xhaka off and put Ramsey on. If you're trying to protect it, if you're trying to get the goal, you take Coquelin off and bring Ramsey in. But if you're trying to protect it, then you take Xhaka.
I'm really upset that you're crushing my dream of a Xhaka Ramsey midfield, Ian.
I'm not crushing it, because that is what I've been waiting for. For you guys, as big of fanboys of Xhaka as you are, that Ramsey's my guy. So that's what I've been waiting for, to see that pairing.
Well, we're all a match made in heaven then.
I know, because I think for the 25 minutes or whatever, how long we saw it, I thought it looked very good, actually. I thought when Xhaka was playing as that lone holding midfielder, I thought he did quite well. I think he had, I think he won 5 out of 7 tackles. He had 4 interceptions of the ball. He played his role well. He was physical, but he was never reckless. And when he won the ball, he immediately looked forward. And I think, you know, and I've said this before, so I don't want to sound repetitive, but I think you can replicate that Ramsey-Arteta partnership of several years ago with Xhaka and Ramsey, except Xhaka is an infinitely better player than Arteta. So I think they complement each other well. I thought it looked good for that short amount of time. I don't think we're going to see it against Manchester United. I tend to think we see Coquelin and Cazorla if he's back, or Xhaka if Cazorla is not healthy. But what did you guys think of that midfield partnership for the brief time we did see it?
See, I thought it worked pretty well. I mean, Ramsey, when he's playing in that spot there, we all know the drawback to him is he doesn't like to play wide. If you put him on the wing, he comes inside anyways. So him being inside and having Xhaka, who was playing positionally, pretty positionally sound, that gave him the ability to go and roam and try and pick up space. And I thought he had a lot of, I thought he had a good impact on the game. I mean, I also saw a lot of hate out there for the game that he played. So I don't know if I was missing something or if that's just Arsenal fans being Arsenal fans.
Bill, let you take that one.
Yeah, that's probably Arsenal fans being Arsenal fans, because I think in the game in the Champions League midweek with him out on the right, and somebody alluded to this on Twitter as well, like Ramsey was almost like Coquelin to a degree, just hated being on the right, roamed to the middle, went on the left. There was absolutely nobody but the right back on the right, Jenkinson, I believe, and was just leaving him alone. But when he plays in that center part of the midfield, and especially next to the wonderful, beautiful Granit Xhaka, I think that, you know, I didn't see him have a negative game at all. You got to remember, second game back, limited, pretty serious reoccurring injury for him. And I really think that he offers a different dynamic. I think he's allowed to roam a little bit in that role. I think when he's fully fit, he'll be able to recover better. And, you know, I don't like all the flicks and tricks and whatever, but if he can get his form back and he can start playing well, I really think with, you know, the, you know, Walcott on the right and having Ozil in front of him, I think he really has a lot to choose from.
I didn't like some of the attempted shots he took, because I think they were in situations where there was a better ball to be played in. But I'll give him a little bit of a pass because he's just coming back from injury. I will say, I think Wenger's thinking has always been 2 different midfield pairings, Coquelin, Cazorla, and Xhaka Ramsey. I don't think he necessarily wanted to play Xhaka, Coquelin. I just think it's kind of circumstance that led to that. Just based on comments he's made about pairings and, you know, not necessarily wanting to change one player for another, but rather having two different complementary skill sets that work together. So I'm hoping moving forward, Jacques Ramsey is the partnership. But I did want to get your guys' take on another issue that I've seen kind of pop up on Twitter, is that, you know, a lot of people said, oh, we miss Santi Cazorla, you know, because he's the link between defense and attack. And, you know, I think a lot of the times when a player is out injured, we tend to almost overrate their impact on the team, you know, because I think if you look at the games Cazorla's played, Southampton, Burnley, PSG, you know, these were games we struggled in midfield. We, you know, where we weren't necessarily creating much in those games. So I think this idea that somehow Santi coming back is going to be the savior, I think is a little bit presumptuous. Like, certainly he's a fantastic player and provides us, you know, a part of our game that no one else can. But do you think, am I wrong on this? Maybe am I not giving him enough credit?
I think you're right. I mean, you're right. I get that's all we really saw was, oh, well, if Cazorla was in there, we win the game. And like you said, I think you're spot on, because he's important to how we keep the rhythm up. And I know I've touched on it before in previous podcasts that he's kind of like the metronome that keeps our attack going. And I think, you know, Xhaka brings a bit of that same quality when he gets on the ball. He doesn't hold the ball for a long time. You know, he holds it a little more than Cazorla, but like I said before, I think the biggest impact was that they were able to find a way to take Ozil out of that game. He's what makes our team tick, regardless of anybody else on the field. He's the most important player on the team. And if Cazorla was in with Xhaka, yeah, sure, maybe I could see us being better going forward. But if you were going to have Cazorla and Coughlin in there, I don't see it being any different.
Yeah.
I think that especially with this last game, I think Coughlin is where Cazorla would have been to start the game. And then Coughlin probably would have been back, or Xhaka or whoever. And, you know, I just think we're talking about how disjointed it looked with, you know, people being lost in space and things like that. You know, I think that he's good at linking up the play, like we said before. But I don't know. He adds just something special with the way he moves around and he passes. I'm not saying he's the ultimate missing link, but, I mean, he starts for a reason. And, you know, he's, you know, just so good on the ball and so good getting the ball around that I think – that, you know, Alex, as you said, the Coughlin Cazorla pairing is definitely good and works out, because he controls so much of it and can move the ball so well that Coughlin can sit back and not have to get that much involved. I honestly think that when he comes back, it'll actually help. But it just seems, and I read some reports on Twitter earlier in the summer, like somewhere in like July, I think, that he may only play, or was only maybe scheduled to play like 15 to 20 games or something to manage this injury problem that he's been having. I don't know what the truth is to that, but one of the big Twitter guys, AFC Twitter guys, I think said that. And I did some researching the other day and I was like, oh yeah, that tweet was out there. So I don't know if that's the truth or what.
You know, I think there's something to that, because with an Achilles injury, those don't go away. You know, that's not something where once you come back from it, you're 100% recovered. There's always going to be an increased likelihood of that flaring up, not necessarily to the same extent, but to the point where you're going to miss a couple weeks here and there. And, you know, this idea that we should base our midfield around a guy in his early 30s with an Achilles problem is a little bit problematic to me.
Right.
You know, so I think you know, obviously this is looking in the future, but I think in the future you kind of need to find that sort of, in the transfer window, like that needle type player who can, you know, dribble in midfield, control things, short passes, and versatility. You know, so I think that's somewhere we need to look, because we can't depend on someone with that sort of injury. But you know, speaking of guys that get injured a lot, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who came on for one of the worst substitute cameos I think I've seen in recent memory. And I'm not being facetious at all when I say that. I don't know what that was when he came on. For those who didn't get to see the game, he came on for Iwobi, I think. He came on for Theo Walcott. Sorry, he came on for Walcott, which I thought was an okay substitution at the time, because Ox has shown some glimpses here and there. But my God, like, I'm literally struggling for words right now, because I've never seen that sort of cameo from this Arsenal team. You know, I know Ox is a confidence player, but Jesus, he was misplacing passes right and left. He was launching crosses over the end line. Am I overstating how bad he was, guys? Help me out here.
No, I think you're spot on. I was just shaking my head. I mean, one of the first plays he made where he tried to play the ball out wide to Bellerin and put it 30 yards over his head. Like, I don't get it. You know, if he's a confidence player, he's been scoring goals. He's been playing relatively well. I mean, you're scoring goals, you should be high on confidence. He scored more goals this season than he has in any other season for us.
It's so frustrating. I don't understand it. Like, you know, one of these wide receivers on one of the teams that I watch here, you know, they're complaining about people in the papers writing how they drop passes. Well, catch the ball, you know what I mean? And it's the same thing. Like, Chamberlain came out and said, oh, he wants to play, blah, blah, blah. And then you come in and you put in that type of performance in a North London derby of all games. I've been watching a long time. I have never seen a substitute performance that bad. And I've seen some pretty bad games. And I don't even know if it's selfish play, unintelligent play. You could put so many adjectives on it, but one thing about all of them is they're all negative, and that's a problem.
You know, and Bill, you and I think it was right. It was the two of us that we got in this discussion on Twitter probably a couple weeks ago now, right, about Ox and what the problem is with him. And I just think he lacks the awareness and the intelligence needed to play in this Arsenal team. You know, let's think about the times when he's looked his best. Very rarely is it ever in link-up play or in a team move. It's almost always something a solo effort. Anytime he gets into a position where he has to make a decision on, okay, do I take this player on or do I cross the ball? Do I shoot it or do I play it wide? Almost every single time, without fail, he makes the wrong decision. You know, it's not a selfish thing, because if it was a selfish thing, he would always take a player on or he would always shoot. But, you know, he had that one cross from the right where there was not a single person in the box. Look, I'm not even going to mention the fact that he put it well over the end line and not even in play. There's nobody in the box to cross to. He had Ozil coming square to him. Could knock the ball to him square, but he tries to play across into nobody.
I think there's definitely a lack of game intelligence there and game awareness. I don't know what it is. I think Ian, you mentioned he's a confidence player, but I mean, this is a confidence player like on a whole different level, because when one thing goes wrong, his entire game capitulates. You know, and that with that early misplaced ball you mentioned, it's like after that happened, nothing he did was going to come off. You just knew after he did that, you knew, okay, he's going to have one of those kind of games. And it's frustrating, because I think what you said about him having these solo moments is spot on. When you think about Oxlade-Chamberlain's best moments for Arsenal, they almost always involve him, you know, just going on a weaving run or taking a bunch of players on. It's never necessarily part of
or hitting the post.
Yeah, exactly. But it's never like him being involved in like a seven pass sequence that leads to a goal. You know, I think back to that game at Bayern away where he dribbled past like eight or nine Bayern players and then got taken down for a foul. And you were just like, okay, that was incredible. Or against AC Milan at home, where he played midfield in the Champions League several years ago and he won a penalty and he just controlled the first half of that game. It's, you see these flashes from him, but the larger substance of his career has been fairly unproductive. I mean, I think, Ian, you mentioned his goal scoring record, that this is the most goals he scored in any season, and he scored five. A winger should be scoring more than five goals in a season. It should not have taken him six seasons to get that sort of goal scoring record on
goal scoring record. The fact, right, you said it right there, six seasons, and if he's been in this team around this first team for that long, and he still looks like a player that we just brought in from another club. He doesn't look like a player that's been in the side for 6 years. You think by now he would be settled in and would have been able to figure out our style of play. You know, that to me right there is he's shown no improvement whatsoever in that time. His technical ability is phenomenal. I think as a player, he could be a fantastic player. He has all the skill in the world. He lacks every single mental thing you need to have to put it all together. Like, I know, and that sounds harsh, but name one thing he does, like, no, it's, from a mental, tactical, positional standpoint, that
it's like,
is a positive.
It's like
nothing.
Somebody said it before. I don't know who it was, but every decision he makes is the wrong one. You wonder how he doesn't just think, like, on the next decision, all right, what do I – it just seems like there's no process. It just seems like, you know, training ground session, if I lose the ball, whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just so odd. But it is – I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there asking for him to come in over Alex Iwobi, and then he comes in, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is what's coming off of the bench? Like, where's Rosicky? I'd take him at this point again. You know,
I'd take Flamini. At least he's
right, now you're going a little over.
No. Hey, Flamini knocked them out of the League Cup last year. Don't forget. But I think Bill, you brought up a great point about there's no process. You can almost, with other players, you can sort of see the wheels turning in their head when they're playing. You can see their thought process. You can see how they try to utilize space. You know, that every movement is to set up the next movement. So I think with Ox, you know, he relies on sheer physical ability, perhaps more than anyone in the team. And he has that physical ability. That's the frustrating part. But, you know, you still have to combine it with the tactical and technical awareness needed, you know, at this top level.
If you're going to – you can get by on that purely physical ability if you play for a side that sits back and counters and has one or two guys going forward. You know, for me – he's somebody that should be playing at a mid to low table team that is going to sit and counter and needs that one guy that, you know, when they counter up the wing, can make a play and score a solo goal.
Yeah. I feel like he'd be perfect for Crystal Palace.
You know, I was just thinking the same exact thing, and he reminded me, the player that came to mind was Bolasie.
Yeah, I think that's a good shout. Yeah.
That's, you know, and I don't know that entirely. That's just what popped in my head, because he does have a lot of those similar things. And, you know, I'm really looking to find a positive for him, for Ox. And, you know, something that I could maybe latch on to and say, you know what, this is the sign that he's finally getting it, that he's going to develop into the player that clearly Arsene thinks he can still be, or else he wouldn't be with this club anymore. You know, and I really cannot find a single thing that I've seen over the last three seasons. You know, we'll give him the first couple. He was young. He was getting used to a new team, getting used to being at a big club. So in the last 2.5 years, I can't put my finger on a single thing that makes me think he's going to get it.
And I think, to your point, yeah, there hasn't been any consistent sign that he's going to do that. You know, at some point you can't rely on flashes of brilliance. You have to show consistent production. And, you know, on the complete flip side of Oxlade-Chamberlain is Mesut Ozil, because we've seen consistent production this season from him. But I don't think you're ever going to see a more spectacular goal than you saw from him against Ludogorets. I cannot tell you how many times I have rewatched that goal in slow motion, in fast motion, and every single motion known to man. You know, the importance of that goal could, you know, not just from a single game, but the fact that it could impact our Champions League chances, I don't think it can be understated at all. I mean, first of all, I just want to get your guys' take on that goal and then kind of how it impacts the, you know, us moving forward with a big game against PSG at home in a couple weeks.
Bill, I'll let you go first here because I need to regather my thoughts because I just thought about that goal again. So,
I honestly, it is going to be such an important goal for the club in terms of Champions League this year. They, you know, as soon as it was happening, I was like, I didn't think that he had the composure in his locker to be able to do that because you don't see him scoring a lot. You know, you always see him assisting and providing all of those beautiful goals. You never think that he could produce one. But the flick over, first of all, the touch from the pass from Elneny, the flick over the keeper, the one dummy, the other dummy, and then the cool pass into the corner. I think that getting those 3 points away from home is huge. Because I know Wenger always talks about get the 3 points at home, draws on the road, 12 points gets you into the next round, you know, the whole nine yards. But I think they have a chance to win the group. I think winning the group is important regardless if they get Bayern or Real Madrid, if that were to be the case. But, you know, even if so, those teams don't look great. And I think in the Champions League, the players seem to have that other level that they like to go up to, and that was shown in Ozil's goal. And what a time to score it at the end of the game. I flipped my ottoman over.
When I saw him go through, I was sitting there on the couch talking to my wife, and the ball came over the top, and I saw him go one-on-one. He chipped the keeper. My hands just went up in the air, and I just didn't move, and he put it in. I just looked at her, and I said, "That was fucking unbelievable." I mean, you hit it right there. The word you used was composure. And that was, you know, did you see how incredibly excited he was after he scored that goal?
Oh, he loved it. And I think there's something to be said because my wife was watching it with me as well. So there's some good energy there or something. I don't know. You know.
But like the thing about that is, the way he reacted, like he usually reacts pretty good when he scores a goal, but the way he reacted,
so pumped.
To me, it shows that he knew how important that moment was. And when he scored that goal, when that was going on, he looked like he was in a training session.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that composure that a lot of times gets misconstrued as laziness, I think. And You know, I love that he's finally scoring these goals and it's really starting to kind of shove it in the face of all these pundits. Like, hey guys, you know, you want to say, oh, Hazard, Coutinho, De Bruyne, oh, they're the best attacking midfielders in the Premier League. Hey guys, I'm right here. Don't forget about me because I'm better than all of them.
First of all, with the pundit talk, I mean, you can tell who the legitimately uninformed pundits are by their opinions on Mesut Ozil. And I don't say that just being biased as an Arsenal fan. I say that as a football fan, you know. If you watch Mesut Ozil and you can't appreciate his quality, you don't understand the game. Everything he does serves a purpose. Every movement, every pass, everything is designed to, you know, utilize space to create openings for teammates. And, you know, I think, Bill, you mentioned, or one of you mentioned the laziness narrative. I mean, that's the stupidest thing. First of all, he covers up, you know, either top or second top most distance in the team almost every game. But because, you know, he doesn't shout a lot or yell a lot, or doesn't show passion, you know, like that somehow is held against him. But that's just
one more thing. One more thing on that laziness point. I know I'm interrupting a whole lot today. If I'm not mistaken, didn't people say Thierry Henry was lazy as well? Because he didn't do – I mean, it's a different position, but it was still that same incredible understanding of space. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just want to throw that out there.
I think
that narrative was out there about him as well.
And well, if you notice who pushes that narrative, it's usually these nothing players who were former Premier League players who accomplished nothing. So the one thing that they could provide was running around a lot. So these are the people who rate Jordan Henderson.
I think it's an English thing. But
I think you see it from like smart pundits who can appreciate what he's doing. You know, like you see like Martin Keown or Lee Dixon, you know, guys like that understand it. Granted, they're former players, but just as intelligent ex-pros, you know, they see that. But like you see a guy like I don't know what's his name, Jamie Redknapp or guys like that, you know, who say, oh, well, you know, he needs to put himself about more. He needs to, you know, show more passion. Like, first of all, there's a reason England hasn't won a World Cup in 40 years, because the game is not about passion. It's about ability on the ball, ability to make things happen.
Yeah, passion's the X factor that gets you over the top.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
you know,
well,
like,
well, if that was the case, the U.S. would have won a couple World Cups by now.
That's the thing. Like,
that's what I mean. It has to all come together. You know?
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, with passion, like, that's the baseline. I feel like you should expect passion and hard work,
right.
The technical ability that you need, and you know, he has it on a level that no one else does. And you know, you saw it when he was at Real Madrid. When he's with the elite players, he can put up assist numbers for fun, but he's adjusted his game since he came to take on more of a leadership role on the field, not in terms of screaming and yelling, just on the field and scoring goals. And, you know, Ian, like you said, scoring more goals this season, getting into goal scoring positions. He's definitely increased that ability. He's making so many great runs this season. By the way, when he scored, I literally did a knee slide on my carpet. And I did his little M salute to his niece while my girlfriend was watching this happen. I swear to God, I did the slide and I did that little thumb sucking celebration. I have no idea why I thought that was a thing I should be doing, but you know, it's just he's why you watch football. This is a very long winded explanation, though, but he's why you watch football. You watch it for that kind of magic where he just makes things look effortless. And, you know, we're going to need that in that game against PSG, because that's really going to dictate who wins the group. You know, I think a draw wouldn't be the worst result, but then, you know, we're left going into a tough game at Basel. So I think we need to win this game. And, you know, how are you guys feeling about that one?
Bill, I'll send it to you first here.
I think I really think they could actually beat PSG at home. I don't think that we should go for a draw. I think that we should go for the 3 points. I really think that they can come out on the group. I've been talking with this kid on Twitter that I've been talking to, a guy on Twitter I've been talking to for a long time. And he just says he has this weird feeling about this year. And he predicts like things all the time. It's so strange. And we were just talking about it. We think we're going to win the group. We think we're going to probably face a tough opponent that we'll probably overcome and get through a couple of games, get into the final, and then see where it goes, you know. But I really think that's a major, major goal of Wenger's. I think the players know it, and showing by the game so far, even though the last one started out so, I think that there's a real nerve about the players to advance, get through, and see, you know, see what they can do in the, you know, in the final, if they can get to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously the PSG game is huge, and the fact that it's at home, you know, I want to say that's a good thing, but we've shown a tendency to not have as good a home form as we do road form. But I think that has a lot to do with the opponents coming into our building, because, you know, obviously it's the same thing. We struggle against teams that sit back. We're not going to have that problem with PSG. We know PSG is not going to sit back. And I think we're going to see a hell of a game, that's for sure. You know, I definitely see us winning the game. It's going to be up and down. It's going to be open. It's going to be exciting. Wenger is going to hate the game that we're going to go out and play, because it's going to be so open. But I see us coming out on top of that. And like you said, Bill, that the players, you get a sense from the players' attitudes in these Champions League games about how important they're taking this competition this year. I think in the past we've seen it where it's almost like we're disinterested. Not disinterested, but that it isn't – like that we knew that we were going to get out of the group stage and then either lose in the round of 16 or the round of 8, you know, and that we were more focused on the league. But there's a noticeable difference in the attitude of our guys this year in the Champions League, that they're going to make sure they get it done. So I think I have full confidence that we'll beat PSG and top the group. knowing our luck, somebody, like you said, Bayern, Real Madrid, or Barcelona will just find a way to finish second in their group, and we'll draw them in the next round. But because that's just the Arsenal way, as most people would say.
Yeah. Before we wrap up this segment, I want to go off of what you just said. The potential teams we could draw in the round of 16, even if we win the group. So in the Bayern Atletico Madrid group, one of those two teams is going to finish second. In the Real Madrid Borussia Dortmund group, one of those teams is going to finish second. And in the Barcelona Manchester City group, granted, we can't draw Manchester City, but suppose Manchester City was to finish first, we could draw Barcelona. So, if we draw Barcelona, I'm going to kill myself.
But you know what? To win that competition, you got to beat the best. So. Yeah,
but I'd like to play the best a little later. You know,
I'd like to be like Real Madrid that one year. They didn't play anybody.
Yeah, they got to the final. Until the final. Playing like Wolfsburg or something like that, you know? I mean.
Yeah, that'd be nice for once.
Yeah, give us like Bayer, like, I don't want to insult any team by throwing them out there, but like just give us someone average.
And then, you're not insulting anybody by saying they're not on the level of Bayern, Real Madrid, or Barcelona. Yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know, like in Leicester's group, there's some pretty awful teams. So give us one of those teams. But,
you know. If I had to pick one of the big teams to play, bring on Borussia Dortmund, because not only are they incredibly exciting to watch, we will get to see the now 18-year-old American superstar. And I hope you guys are as proud of my transition.
I was literally
that was a great transition.
One of the best transitions in the history of podcast transitions. For those who do not know, we were going to talk about the U.S. men's national team at some point, and I was trying to see how that we were going to transition from Arsenal to that. Ian Smith just did it, so if you're listening, give that man a round of applause.
I had to mention that because I didn't know where I was going with that, and it just kind of
saved
into place.
Saved it there.
So, you know, on that note, we just had the roster come out for the U.S. national team. I believe it was yesterday.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I can read those names out to everyone real quick.
Go for it, yeah.
Yep, so we got Jozy Altidore, Alejandro Bedoya, Matt Beisler, Steve Birnbaum, Michael Bradley, John Brooks, Cameron Carter-Vickers, Timmy Chandler, Omar Gonzalez, Lyndon Gooch, Julian Green, Brad Guzan, Ethan Horvath, Tim Howard, Aaron Johansson, Fabian Johnson, Jermaine Jones, Sasha Kljestan, Jordan Morris, Michael Orozco, the aforementioned Christian Pulisic, Caleb Stanko, Bobby Wood, Willem Yarborough, DeAndre Yedlin, and Graham Zusi. Initial thoughts just hearing those names, first of all.
You know what name's not on that list?
Oh, I can think of a few, but I'm gonna guess you're going with
Chris Wondolowski. Do it, Bill.
I'm gonna go with Chris Wondolowski.
Oh, it's about time, right?
I think there was a resounding sigh of relief when that name and Kyle Beckerman's name were not on this roster.
For me, the more surprising of those two is Beckerman. Polish.
Oh, yeah.
That's the more surprising one to me is Beckerman, to be honest.
I'm glad. I'm hoping this is indicative of us moving forward, because I don't think you can rely on players like that anymore. To be honest, I don't think you should be relying on guys like Zusi anymore either, but one step at a time. But in all seriousness, looking at this roster, I'm kind of excited. I like a lot of the young attacking talent that's there. You know, we got Pulisic, you got Jordan Morris doing good things for Seattle, Bobby Wood, Julian Green sort of back in the fold, Lyndon Gooch really getting a good run with Sunderland. How are you guys feeling about, you know, some of the young guys brought in?
That's I think the most, my favorite thing about the roster is, you said it there, the young guys. I think Klinsmann is finally starting to make that transition from the old guard to the guys that we're going to need to have at the next World Cup. And you know, seeing names like, you know, not that he's going to feature for us, but Cameron Carter-Vickers, seeing his name on there, I think, is a step in that direction. Obviously, Pulisic, which wasn't even in doubt, but Julian Green, Lyndon Gooch, Jordan Morris, for, you know, if you still want to consider him a young player, I think he still does because his national team career is still relatively young. But I think, yeah, that's to me the most impressive, the most important thing is that that transition that we were hoping to see a year ago is starting to take effect. You know, I don't know. Go ahead, Bill.
No, I was just going to say the transition is definitely in effect. We're starting to see him have more faith in younger players, and it's no shock that players playing abroad are getting more of a fair shake like they should, because they're getting put to the test. And a lot of them are, you know, like we've seen with Dempsey and some in the past, even Donovan, they are succeeding abroad. And I think that it's more comforting for me to now be able to see more of these young players get a shot, do well on the national level, and actually feel comfortable two summers from now, you know, just saying, okay, there's these guys here, there's going to be more. And I think the next World Cup is going to be good, but I think the one after that is going to be the one to look at, because I think that's where you're going to see these guys almost be the old guard in a way, and have this other crop that they've been working with the past 6 years or so before that get up there. And I think it'll be good. I'm happy to finally see a change, because it makes me feel better. And Wondolowski out.
And I think that that infusion of energy is exactly what a lot of US fans have wanted, you know, because I think with a lot of these guys, you knew what they could provide, and mostly you knew what they couldn't provide. You know, I'm not going to pick on him that much longer, but Wondolowski, you know, he's not going to do anything against teams that actually matter. Same with Beckerman, you know, he's going to get, you know, he'll sit back and he'll defend and he'll try hard, but he's outclassed against elite competition. And with the type of talent Mexico has, you know, Chicharito, Gio Dos Santos, Hector Herrera, all these guys, you know, playing, you know, in really good form, I think for once we have some, like, this belief that on a technical level we match up. You know, we've beaten them Dos a Cero in Columbus before, where we haven't necessarily had the more talented team. We just played the American style and it worked out. But I think
passion.
Passion and heart and all the other shit Alexi Lalas says.
Oh my God. You still listen to him?
No, but that's what I'm saying. Like he's the one who spouts like nonsense to these uninformed fans, and then they say, oh, see, Lalas said that we should line up in a 4-4-2, so why isn't Klinsmann doing it? I'm like, if you're listening to that ginger freak, then you're stupid.
Guys, Klinsmann, you know, Klinsmann just got some, I forget what the heck they call it or what it was even for.
In Germany,
he just got some award from the Chancellor of Germany for being one of the most influential people in German sport. He's like one of five people to win this award. To be given this honor, but we're gonna sit here and say, take what Alexi Lalas says. Oh, Klinsmann doesn't know what he's doing. Are you kidding me?
Like, yeah, Bob. I mean, Bob, the 50-year-old MLS fan sitting on his couch, knows better than Klinsmann. Sure.
Oh my God! If we didn't need any more confirmation, I mean,
hey, well, he goes to the game every weekend, so he must know, right? You know, like
no, but in all seriousness, I think Bill's point is a really good one about transition and about bringing in that young core that is going to become the core of the squad moving forward. You look at a guy like Pulisic, the guy to me who has almost become an indispensable part of the team is John Brooks. And if you remember when he was called in, not a lot of people knew who he was, you know, because he wasn't MLS developed or because, you know, this bias against the German American players, and he came in and he got slaughtered with criticism, but yeah. He's cemented his place at Hertha Berlin, a really good team in the Bundesliga. If you guys haven't checked them out, and now he's become a mainstay of the U.S. back line. I think he's probably the first name on the team sheet or one of the first names on the team sheet. But looking at the list of guys to partner with him, keep in mind we have no Jeff Cameron. You know, in defense, where are we looking? Who would you guys like to see? I assume you see Fabian Johnson at left back, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see Fabian Johnson at left back, Yedlin at right back, you would think. Brooks and either Birnbaum or Beisler would be my thought.
I think maybe
Omar Gonzalez you might see in there, but
I don't know against Mexico if he'd go with Gonzalez. Maybe Birnbaum.
He's shown a tendency to trust Birnbaum over Beisler.
Right. That's why I was saying that. I don't. Maybe he might start Omar. I think Birnbaum gets it though.
I would probably agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would go with Birnbaum as well. I just want to give a shout to DeAndre Yedlin. He's getting consistent games at Newcastle now.
And they're killing it.
Yeah, and I think you're really starting to see like major improvement in his game, not just offensively, because he's always had pace and he's good going forward, but defensively, I think the Championship is a tough league. It really makes you work, and you have to focus on playing both ways, and I think he's really developing well there. So kudos to him. You know, in attack, I'm really curious to see how we line up. You know, my initial thought is you play a 4-2-3-1, so at least we have three guys in midfield, because I think if you play 4-4-2, Mexico's technical ability in midfield, I think they'll outnumber us in there, and I think they'll be able to control the game. I think if you play Kleshchen, Bradley, and Jones would be probably what I would go with, and then, you know, Pulisic on the right, maybe Bedoya on the left, and then you got, you know, guys like Zusi or Green or,
I'd like to see Green play, I'd like to throw him out there. It's a big occasion, but I'd like to see what the kid's got.
That's a tough spot to throw him into there. I have a feeling we see Bedoya on the right, but I would love to see Green come in as a sub, you know, if we're chasing the game. And then, you know, play one of Josie or Bobby Wood up top. But would you guys rather go with the two strikers and Josie and Wood, or, you know, go with what I said with the 4-2-3-1?
You know, I think the way I see Josie, it's similar to how I see Olivier Giroud at, you know, with Arsenal.
Except less handsome.
Well, obviously. Yeah. I mean, I refer to him as Big Sexy every time he comes on the pitch. So, you know, when he came on, my tweet was, "It's Big Sexy time." So, I think, you know, the problem is that I don't think we can really afford to accommodate both Josie and Bobby Wood up top. I think that, you know, it's difficult because I don't know who you play on the other side. My thought is give Jordan Morris a shot out wide, because he does bring that pace and attacking, you know, that attacking mindedness that we want. But I think obviously we're just kind of guessing. My thought is he goes with probably Bedoya on the right. He's shown a tendency to trust him. Either him or Zusi on the right, and Pulisic on the other side with, I don't know. I don't know if he goes with Josie or Bobby Wood up top. I'd like to see Bobby Wood. Bobby Wood, I don't remember the exact numbers, but he scored more than half of his club team's goals this year.
Yeah, he has to play.
I think he has to. You know, I don't know. He's playing against better competition. You know, on the thing about better competition, somebody made a point earlier about we're seeing the European players, the European-based players get more of a shot. Do you guys want to take a guess? I counted it up, and if I can count, then my number's right. Out of the 26 people called into this team, how many do you think are from MLS teams?
Let's say 8 or 9.
One, two.
Without counting.
No, that's cheating.
Sorry. 7.
You know, you underguessed it a little bit. I guess I kind of set it up to make you think that there was going to be more Europeans. Yeah, there's 10. Only 10 of 26 players are based in MLS.
That's not shocking.
That's what I like to hear, honestly.
I feel like that's better. You know,
no, that's absolutely what you want to see at this point. I think you want to see the guys competing at the highest level. I think for a while we got stuck in this, cycle of just calling MLS guys in, and you don't want the core of your squad to be from MLS, at least not at this point. You know, people are going to take that as me bashing MLS. No, the fact of the matter is, you know, MLS is improving, but you're not going to beat world-class teams on a regular basis if your squad is primarily from MLS. So just, you know, kind of going off what you said about guys coming in from Europe, some of the names here, Caleb Stanko, Aaron Johansson back in the fold, Lyndon Gooch. So, you know, I think you're seeing that we have guys now making a difference overseas, but not just one or two guys. I think a lot of guys in the player pool are at least getting game time, and I think that's all that can only help things when you have competition for spots and it's actual good competition.
You know, I'll save my MLS bashing for another podcast, but you know, that really is another podcast for sure. I'm not going to get into it. You know, let's just, you know, look at Italy, for example. Giovinco, best player in MLS, hands down. Their manager came out today and said, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was something along the lines of, he's playing in a league that just nobody cares about or isn't good enough, or it doesn't matter. I don't remember the exact quotes, but it was something along those lines where you're not just seeing it, you know, you're not just seeing it with Klinsmann. Like, Klinsmann says it and he gets crucified in the press. The Italian manager comes out and says, well, that's why I didn't pick him, because he's playing in MLS. So in order to, you know, for us to start competing technically, you do need to see the players brought in from the European clubs. And it's, I don't know if it was these players just weren't quite ready. You know, I think Klinsmann, you know, he came out and said early on what his timeline was, when he wanted to bring in these players from, start bringing in the younger players and bring, which meant the Europe from the European clubs, because there are no top American players coming through the MLS. So you're starting to see that transition. And in my opinion, it's because those players are finally ready. You know, they're breaking into their first teams. You're seeing Lyndon Gooch break into the first team. You're seeing Christian Pulisic break into the first team. You're seeing John Brooks establish himself as probably their first name on the team sheet for his club. You're seeing Julian Green. He's not getting a ton of games, but he is on the bench at Bayern Munich for the vast majority of their games. You're seeing these guys establish themselves.
And has scored.
Exactly. Aaron Johansson, you saw him. He's getting games. He's getting starts. And a year and a half ago, that wasn't happening. So I think that now that these players are establishing themselves with their clubs, and I think you saw that the last time around too, where he didn't call guys like Lyndon Gooch in. He did call Green in, but he didn't call Johansson in. Those guys, he left them with their club because they were starting to break into their team. And the impression I got from it was he told them, I'll call you guys in a future date. Stay with your club. Keep working. Keep making an impact. And you're going to get your chance. So, you know.
No, absolutely.
That's the most positive sign for me, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's a mentality issue. When you're in Europe, your spot's never going to be guaranteed to you. You know, you're always going to have competition for your spot. And I think it's, you come out a better player when you fought for your spot, you know, because it's brought out the best in you. And, you know, all the names you mentioned are certainly accurate there. I just want to say that quote from the Italian manager, Ventura. He said, the number of goals Giovinco scores matters less because his quality makes a difference in MLS. And he said, Giovinco plays in a league that doesn't matter much.
There we go.
So naturally, all the MLS defenders in the media who at the slightest hint of criticism towards MLS have to come running out and saying, oh no, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't understand. Why don't you give MLS a shot? This and that. It was just funny to watch them get up in arms about that, when the fact is Antonio Conte said it when he didn't pick Giovinco for the Euro team. And then everyone's like, oh, well, Italy's going to struggle anyways and see. And then they end up going to the quarterfinals, I think.
But Alex, the MLS pundits know more than the guys who manage the Italian national team.
I was going to say, I saw this tweet from Rob Stone at Fox, and he said something about the arrogance of the Italian national team is disconcerting, something like that. I'm like, if any team has deserved to be arrogant about their spot in international football, it's Italy. very few teams have had the international success they are. But no, because you work for Fox, who, let's face it, is a disgrace to soccer coverage everywhere, you think that, and because you've got a contract with MLS, you have to cover them, you think that, oh, God forbid someone actually criticizes the league, we have to step in and say something. But Bill, I'm going to throw it to you because I'm going to start ranting otherwise.
Is anybody going to take anyone at Fox's opinion seriously? I mean, Rob Stone, yes, maybe. But when you see him starting to jump on the wagon and getting on that stuff, you know that it's just a little too much there. I mean, every time I watch their stuff, there is nothing of substance there. It's all slapstick comedy, who could bust who, and you don't get any real substance. It's a joke.
You know what, though? The problem is that people take it seriously, though.
Right, that's the issue, and it's the MLS people to tune in to watch, and they think that these guys are the Holy Grail, and they're absolute jokes. I mean, Barton had a great playing career, but other than that, he's an absolute crock as a pundit.
And I think Alex hit it right on the head, though, is, I mean, for the informed fans, they know better. They know better not to listen to them, but the broader audience that MLS is trying to grab and trying to bring into the sport, the new U.S. soccer fans that don't know any better, that's who they see. So they say, oh, these people know more about it than I do, so they have to be right. You know, and that's it. That's such a big problem.
Oh, it's a huge problem.
Yeah, because ultimately, if you're trying to grow the game here, but those are the faces you're using to grow it, you're only harming it. You're not helping it. You know, I don't know who's got coverage of the game this Friday, actually. Is it ESPN or Fox?
I'm pretty sure it's Fox.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Okay, well, that's awful news.
Well, we could bring back Fox's tragic hashtag on Twitter, though.
So that will be back. Again. There's no doubt about that.
I'm looking real quick here.
I want to say it's Fox because I saw something on Twitter that said something along the lines of this game got way less interesting.
Yeah.
I saw that it was on Fox.
It's FS1.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's on FS1.
FS1. There's another thing. It's on FS1. It's not on the main. Why is it not on the main network?
Because the network is a joke. I can go on for a 12-year podcast on how bad Fox is, I swear.
I think I'm going to be watching this game in Spanish on Univision. I'm not joking. I will actually watch it in Spanish. I can't deal with Fox. But back to the game, because we got a little sidetracked there with our unanimous hatred of Fox, which I love, actually.
We went way off topic.
No, because I think a lot of soccer fans feel the same way. But in all seriousness, U.S. roster, I think we're starting to see the emergence, because I think there was a transition period where guys like Donovan are no longer there. You know, Howard's getting older. Dempsey's old now. So you needed these guys to build around. First of all, and people say Michael Bradley. I'm like, first of all, if we're building around Michael Bradley, then we're kind of fucked, because I think he's incredibly overrated, but he seems to have a guaranteed spot in the 11. I do still think that there's an over-reliance on older players like Jermaine Jones and, you know, Bedoya to some extent. So, you know, I'd still like to see us move away from that, but
and I think you will there again. I'm just having a really bad problem with interrupting, but
no, you're good.
I think you're gonna see the reliance on Michael Bradley start going away as soon as you can start counting on Lyndon Gooch and Gideon Zalelem and Emerson Hindman. Those three players right there, as they break into their teams and start making more of an impact on the club scene, those are the three players to watch to start cutting into that over-reliance on Michael Bradley.
You would hope so. You know, I think in midfield, it's too long. It's been Bradley and Jones. And I think that's what we're going to see. It's just a question of whether Kleshchen joins them. I actually like Kleshchen. I think he brings a little bit of that creative flair. I know we've discussed that in a previous podcast. But just that ability to pick up a final pass, because I don't think Bradley should play as a number 10. But, you know, I'm curious to hear kind of how you guys see this game unfolding. And, you know, is it going to be another Dos Lacero, or is Mexico going to have too much quality for us? Bill, I'll start with you.
I think that they need to go, you know, the United States need to go in the game a little cautious. I don't necessarily feel a Dos Lacero coming on. If we get one, I will obviously be more than ecstatic. Realistically, I feel maybe a 1-0 or a 1-1. I can't see us losing, knock on wood, knock on Bobby Wood. But I just don't feel that, you know, I'm not too scared of Mexico. I am a little nervous at, you know, even though how good we're talking about all these young players, I am a little nervous of a game like this if a lot of them get a shot together. But regardless of that, I really think I'm thinking 1-0, maybe 1-1. I'd be happy with either, to be honest.
I have to say that I appreciate your optimism, but I'm having a hard time getting on your level.
Yeah.
I hate to say it because I hate not beating Mexico about as much as I hate not beating Chelsea or Tottenham or Man U. I don't think that we're quite there yet. I think we have too many young players.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. I don't want to say this is going to happen. I'm not worried about Pulisic. He's shown that the kid doesn't care about what type of stage he's on. He's going to show up and play his game. You know, he's showing at a Champions League level. He doesn't care. That's not going to faze him. But I'm worried about some of the other young players that we might see in the squad. And for all we know, we may not see very many. You may see Pulisic being the only young player to really get a shot at it.
Right.
Because he may go with Zusi or Bedoya on the right. And I'm concerned that, you know, Mexico has more quality than us. We're at home. We're in Columbus. We do really, really well there. I can see us coming out with a draw. I have a hard time seeing us get the win. So I'm going to be optimistic, as optimistic as I can be. I'm going to go with a 2-2. But I definitely see it being a higher scoring affair.
I have a good feeling for some reason, and I'm not the most optimistic person in the world, so this feeling's a little off-putting to me, honestly. but I don't see Dos Acero. I think maybe 2-1. I think we might score an early goal, and I hate to say this, it's probably going to come off a set piece. I think Mexico will probably hit us right before the halftime break to get the equalizer, and I think we'll score one. Christian Pulisic in the 75th minute to score the game winner and send all Americans home as the happiest people on earth. So I'll go 2-1 US. I do know we do also play Costa Rica away 4 days later, and that's going to be a tough game. Costa Rica's got quality. Certainly, you know, we know Joel Campbell, Keylor Navas, Brian Ruiz, all those guys. So that won't be an easy game at all. So, you know, the games in the hex are tough. And, you know, if you start slow against Mexico, you go into that Costa Rica game needing a win, that could be problematic. So how do you guys, you know, just get a quick prediction on the Costa Rica game and then we can wrap things up.
I think, you know, the pessimist in me wants to say, oh yeah, we go beat Mexico and then Joel Campbell scores a hat trick against us to beat us. I don't really think that's going to happen. I think we draw, like I said, I think we draw Mexico, and then I have a hard time seeing us lose to Costa Rica. So it's going to be a good international, a good World Cup qualifier, international break for the U.S. I think we come out of there with a win and a draw. I don't know about a score, but I'm pretty confident we beat Costa Rica regardless of what happens against Mexico.
I think the Mexico game, now that I'm thinking of it, I'm thinking we beat Mexico. I don't know why. I have that good feeling as well. And I actually think the draw might come against a Costa Rican team with a little bit of a travel and hangover from the win against Mexico and the United States. So I'm going to go win against Mexico. I'm going to stick with my 1-0 just because it's the Gunners in me. And I'm going to go with a 2-2 against Costa Rica.
Ooh. All right, and then for that Costa Rica game, I'll take the U.S. to win 1-0. For some reason, I don't see that being a game with a lot of chances created. We'd probably score some scrappy goal and get out of there. So now that I'm hearing it out loud, I realize I've just predicted us to win both games. But I can't backtrack now because it's on record.
Hey, so. You know what? You know what they say? They say one game at a time. So
exactly. So if we get, if, you know, I think 4 points would be ideal. I think if you get out of these two games with 4 points, I think you take that and you're very happy.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I think all things considered, you know, this is a big stretch for U.S. soccer right now. I think, you know, this is potentially where you start putting some momentum into place moving forward and really identifying your strengths and weaknesses in the squad and cementing your lineup, you know, which sounds weird to say because the 2018 World Cup is 2 years away, but there aren't that many games left until then. So you got to sort of start thinking about this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're spot on that this is the point, and that ties back into the point about the transition to the younger players. Is this is where we start building that momentum going into the rest of qualifying and carrying over into the World Cup. You know, you have to be. I don't think you see too often teams that really struggle through qualifying get to the World Cup and then light it up. You need to carry that momentum through, and this is definitely the spot where we start doing it because we start seeing the new faces.
So, yeah, I definitely agree with that. You know, but I was just gonna ask you guys. Mm-hmm. You know, over the next two games, is there a certain player you might have your eye on, or a certain player you think could be the standout player for the U.S.? You know, Bill, I'll throw that to you.
My eye is always on Christian, just to see how he's progressing, what he's doing. I watch the Bundesliga games to see how often he gets in and what he can contribute. Saw him score a couple of goals, which is nice. But I would like to see if Julian Green has a good contribution over the next two games. That's what I'm going to be looking for, to see if he gets some game time and to see if he could show himself on the national stage. So that's what I'll be looking for.
Yeah, I mean, Alex, I'll send it to you here, and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, I think the guy I'm looking at is Fabian Johnson. I think people almost underappreciate how good he is. We haven't had that sort of quality left back who can also play left midfield, really a versatile player, can play on right side, right back, right midfield. His versatility is key, and I'm really curious to see how that Johnson-Pulisic left-sided combination works out, because I think defensively it might be a little bit frail, but going forward I think they can really produce a nice combo play and hopefully create some chances. So Fabian Johnson's definitely the guy I've got my eye on, just to see kind of how that dynamic works.
You know, for me, obviously Pulisic, it's kind of, to me, he's the most important player for us going into that Mexico game. And it's crazy to put that much on his shoulders. He's only 18, but he's the player in our side that has the ability to take a game where we aren't going to dominate possession. And we know that Mexico is going to carry possession. He's the player that has the ability to make something out of nothing. So I think he's our most important player. The player that I have my eye on, I'm curious to see how DeAndre Yedlin copes with the Mexican attack down the wings. They've got some really good players out there, and Alex made a point earlier about how he's really come along defensively with Newcastle in the championship. So I think this is going to be a huge test for him in dealing with the pace and creativeness of that Mexican attack, and that is going to be, yeah, that's where I'm going to be focused on. So, all right, so I think we are going to wrap things up after that. We know we kind of covered a pretty wide range of topics tonight. We maybe got a little bit rambly on you, but you know, that's what happens when you get us all.
To be fair, anytime you can get me talking about how much I hate Fox, it's not rambling, it's truth, you know?
That is very true.
Bill can back me up on that, you know?
Listen, there is nothing that I would like more than to have a podcast where we really dissect all of those things. But I mean, it's just
if you keep it to about an hour, dude.
I know.
We'll be here for 2.5 hours.
if they provided substance, I would have no problem. But it's all, it's like watching a comedy show with like your dad's old buddies, and you don't know what they're all saying when you're a little kid. You know what I mean? You're just confused constantly.
I know you're going with that. Bill, where can everybody find you on Twitter, man?
Oh, man, everybody can find me at AFC Gooner O.
And Alex?
Yep, you can find me at UF Gooner AJ. Also, I just want to throw out a plug for the Facebook site because I've really tried to get that going. Yes. So it's facebook.com/EuroSnobPod. Please like it. And I, you know, I also have links to all the places where you can subscribe to the podcast there. So please check it out. But yeah, you can find me at UF Gooner AJ, and you can find the podcast at EuroSnobPod. And Ian, where can the folks find you?
You can find me at GunnersFan6. You can also find myself and Alex, and also our friend Steve, some of our stuff on the blog site. That is at eurosnobpod.wixsite.com/home. So you can go and check that out. Alex and Steven have put some player ratings, game reviews, posts like that up. My last one, if you haven't checked it out yet, go check it out. It was my thoughts on Arsene Wenger and whether or not this should be his last season. I'm sure I'll have something up, you know. Actually, it's probably going to be a little bit because as of this weekend, I am out of here for a week.
Oh, so yes, have fun.
So next week, you know, look for something coming up post the international break, post the games this weekend. I'm sure Alex will get a good group together because we also not only do we have to recap the U.S. games, but there is a big fixture in the near future with all of our favorite opposing manager, Jose Mourinho, and the Red Devils of Manchester United. So that is going to be definitely a podcast to listen to and check out. I believe Alex is going to have a United fan on with him.
Yeah, one of my good buddies is a United fan, and so I'm going to try and get him on, and you know, we're going to just kind of debate the different qualities of our sides. And you know, I don't think he's a Mourinho fan, so it'll actually be kind of be interesting to hear what he says.
Okay, we're not going to get into Mourinho, but how could he be a Mourinho fan?
But right. So I'm going to try and organize that for you guys next week. But you know, that should be interesting to listen to.
So before we end up on another tangent about Mourinho or United or anything else, because God knows we could end up there at the drop of a hat. So before we end up there, just want to say thanks for everybody tuning in, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
See you guys.